I put candles out on the back deck after the children go to bed and invite him to watch the stars with me over a glass of wine. I buy sexy underwear and make love to him every night. And I watch him like a hawk. That goes without saying. I haven't been able to access his texts again, but I pay close attention to his moods and take the occasional peek at his emails. I make notes of my progress. "I like this dress on you. It's nice," he said the other day, with a cheeky smile. Unprompted, he will bring me a glass of wine when I'm preparing dinner. He talks to me, and he listens. He's become more attentive, more relaxed and flirty. I call all these things successes in their own right. I'm winning. I'm no longer a team player. I'm a winner. Then, this morning, 5 weeks after I submitted it, I received the call from the journal to congratulate me. The solution has been reviewed and accepted and will be published next month. Its publication will allow you to claim the Penty Stone Prize from the Leo Forrester Foundation, they added. It's official. I have solved the Penty Stone conjecture. And just like that, everything changes. My doubts, my fears vanish with that phone call. I don't care if it's Alex's proof. It's mine, too. I put the phone down and stare at my hands, reminding myself that I came up with the final piece of the puzzle. I banish the voices in my head for good, and after a few minutes of silence, I go to Jeff's office with a grin on my face and butterflies in my stomach. June raises an eyebrow at me, and I put one finger to my lips and wink at her. Then I walk in, close the door after me, and lean against it. "You'll never guess what happened," I say. Then I tell him. He doesn't believe me at first, understandably. Little old me, minute-taker, gopher-errand loser with no ambition whatsoever, suddenly solves a major math problem out of thin air. I pull out the chair opposite his desk. "They're publishing it next month. I just got the call from the journal. Then an email from the Leo Forrester Foundation who want to come here, to the university, I mean, and formally present the prize." He looks at me sideways, squinting. "Is it the 1st of April today?" I smile. "Nope." He picks up the phone and speaks to someone at the journal. He actually had to do that, assert that it was true, that I wasn't just spinning it. Once he's checked the facts, he doesn't speak for a long time, just stares at me. I was really expecting more, and I feel a stab of disappointment. "You're happy?" I ask. "It'll be good for the university." "This is incredible." "I know," I say, relieved. I grin. "But you never said." "I wanted to make sure. And then I didn't get the professorship, so, you know." "There. I'm a winner now. I get to indulge in these little digs." He sits back in his chair and plays with a pen, waves it in the air. He narrows his eyes at me. "Something isn't right." I wait, tilt my head, but his expression doesn't change. It's dark and suspicious. And suddenly I know, and it's like the entire edifice that is my new winning life collapses around me. I screwed up. It's over. I just did a very, very foolish thing, because I'm an idiot. He knows. Of course he knows. How could I have been so stupid? He must know about Alex and the proof. Alex always swore I was the only one he ever told. He made me swear not to tell anyone, especially not Jeff. He convinced me he was paranoid about his work being stolen. I took him at his word, and now it's too late. I've made it official that I'm a thief and a fraud. I open my mouth to say something, formulate an apology, say there was a mistake and I always meant to submit it in his name, when Jeff bursts out laughing. "What?" I ask, blinking. We should be celebrating. There should be champagne. He calls June and asks her to get everyone in here immediately and to bring champagne and glasses. Yes, right now, he says. Yes, I know it's not even lunchtime, he says. Then he gets up and comes round and gives me a big hug. Suddenly everyone is here and everyone is hugging me, even Mila. And everyone is poking and pulling at me and they want to know why I never said anything and how I did it. And I'm laughing because they're all talking over each other. And if I'd known there'd be such a fuss, I would have fixed my makeup. But I am so happy I could burst. I am happier than I've been in years, and this is just the beginning. And I tell them I'll be right back, and with my glass of champagne in my hand, I return to my office and close the door and call Lewis. I did it, I say. Did what? He asks, and I can hear a smile in his voice. I drop mine to a whisper, like this is too special to be said out loud. It's a surprise, I say. But remember last year? All those nights I worked late, and this year too? Of course he remembers. Well, I didn't want to say anything, but I was working on an incredibly important project. I solved a major math problem. There's going to be a prize. $500,000, Lewis. And it's going to be published in the most prestigious journal in the country. Do you love me now? I almost add. Then June comes in holding her own glass and the bottle of champagne. Come on, you. We're all waiting for you. I have to go, I say to Lewis. No, wait. This is wonderful news, Anna. I'm so proud of you, babe. You should have told me. I couldn't tell you. I didn't want to jinx it.
Well, I think you're incredible.
Thank you, darling.
Let's go out and celebrate. You, me, and the kids, he says quickly.
Then he drops his voice to a suggestive whisper.
Or maybe just you and me, what do you say?
I laugh. No, bring the kids. I'd like that.
I'll make a reservation at the Confit d'Oie.
Oh, yes, do that. I've been dreaming of that place. He laughs. June has refilled my glass, and I tell Lewis I really should go.
I love you, babe. I'm so proud of you, he says,
and my heart runneth over. June clinks her glass with mine and takes my arm as we walk back to Jeff's office. Congratulations, Anna. I don't understand what any of this means, but I'm really happy for you. Oh, thank you, June. Back in Jeff's office, he immediately elbows June out of the way, puts one arm around my shoulders, and squeezes.
Let's get drunk after work, you and me. What do you say?
I can't.
Oh, come on, sure you can.
Lewis is taking me and the children out to celebrate.
How lovely. Where is he taking you? June asks.
I move to extricate myself from Jeff's grip. We're going to that new French restaurant over on Fulton Road.
Ooh, very chic, she says.
Yeah, very chic, Jeff quips. I was thinking the sports bar across the road. June, you want to join me? Since we're not good enough anymore?
She rolls her eyes at me.
I don't think so, Jeff.
Another time, then. Meanwhile, let's have a toast. To Anna.
I leave at the end of the afternoon with a feeling of having reached the pinnacle of happiness. I savor every second as I walk out onto the street because I want to remember it all. I want to relive it any time I like. I want to be able to say, remember the day I won the Penty Stone? It was in the fall and the tupelos had turned bright red and the air had that smell of wet leaves, remember? I'm laughing to myself as I swing my satchel back and forth like a child, but as I approach my car, my key already pointed at it. I freeze, the grin still plastered on my face, my hand suspended in midair, my finger poised over the unlock button. At first, I think someone threw dirt on it. Then, as I get closer, I see it's graffiti. But no, it's not graffiti. Across the driver's side, in big, sharp letters, someone has scratched the word whore. I stand there, jaw slack, mouth open, my satchel banging against my legs, then slowly walk around the rest of the car looking for any more vandalism. But there's none. Just that one word. I glance at the other cars on the street, walk up and down a few lengths, but the vandals picked mine, and mine only.
Anna?
I spin around. June is walking towards me, smiling.
Where are you off to? Oh, wait, of course, you're celebrating.
I thought you left ages ago, I say. Didn't you leave ages ago?
I did. Then I decided to do some shopping around here. Everything all right? You look worried.
Then her gaze leaves my face and her hand flies to her mouth.
Is this your car?
I had been trying to stand in front of the word so she wouldn't see it. Now I turn with a sigh to inspect the damage. Yes, it's my car. I can't believe this happened. I knew I should have parked in the parking lot. She bends down to take a closer look, and I see the word in its entirety again instead of as a series of angry score marks. My high from moments ago has crashed like a bad trip. Now I feel like I'm going to cry. I bite the side of my thumb, expecting her to say something like, "Whore, why? What did you do?" But she stands up straight and says,
"Kids, unfortunately it's a bit of a problem around here."
"It is?" She sighs.
"They're bored. There really should be more youth facilities for them. We really need it in this neighborhood. But look, it's just the surface. There's a good auto body place on Bel Air. I'm sure they'll fix that easily."
"Do you think?"
"Yes, I'm sure."
We both stare at the car for a moment.
"Don't worry," she says finally. "They'll have it as good as new, you'll see. Go to your dinner and have fun. It's nothing."
"I know. It's just that I'm supposed to meet my family now, and I just don't want to do it with that." I point at it. "My son is only 10, I add. She makes a face.
"No, you probably shouldn't."
The sky turns gray suddenly, and a gust of wind sends dust into my eyes, and I screw them shut, rub my fingers over them. "I'll have to leave it here. I'll call an Uber." I take out my cell phone and start tapping.
"Would you like me to take your car to the auto body place? It might be a good idea not to leave it here too long, and you can probably pick it up from them tomorrow."
"Oh my God, June, would you? I mean, I wouldn't be putting you out?"
"No, it's no problem, really. Go on, you've had such a great day. Don't let this thing get in the way."
I put my hand on her arm. "Thank you. That is so good of you."
"It's no problem at all. Hey, there you are."
She turns to point at a black car that has stopped beside us. The driver is leaning to signal to us through the passenger window. I motion to him to wait and hand her my car keys. "Thank you, June. I'm so grateful to you. I really am."
"Hey, it's no trouble, really. I'll ask them to call you when it's ready. See you tomorrow, Anna. Have a great time."
I step into the back of the Uber, waving at her. June is right, of course, I think, as I click my seatbelt in. It's nothing, just kids. A prank. Then I close my eyes and remind myself that I'm a winner, and a little bit of vandalism is nothing. And I would be stupid to let it ruin my evening.
Chapter 16. It always fills me with pride when I go out with my family. I imagine the other diners glancing at us and thinking, "What a lovely family. Look at those children, so well-mannered and so sweet. And what a handsome couple they make." Louis says we were lucky to get a table, that they were full, even though this is midweek.
but he explained his wife had just won a mathematics prize for work that's going to change the world, and they shuffled a couple of reservations around to make room for us. "You're kidding," I say. He smiles, his lovely, sexy smile, and a lock of dark hair falls over his forehead. He pushes it back with two fingers.
"You got me."
I laugh. Then Carla hands me a small package. "Oh, honey, what's this?"
"It's not just for me. It's from all of us."
Lewis is watching me with a twinkle in his eye.
"Open it," Maddie says.
I rip the paper off quickly and open a small purple box. Inside is a pair of heart-shaped earrings in delicate silver filigree with small diamonds.
Lewis and I were waiting outside a jewelry store recently. I don't remember why anymore, and I pointed them out because they were heart-shaped. This is what the new, improved me does now. Reacts to heart-shaped jewelry when my husband is within earshot, because everybody knows heart-shaped jewelry is cute and sweet and equals love, and I want to remind him that we're in love and we're cute and sweet. But this is even better. Buying your wife heart-shaped jewelry is a message. It's loud and clear, and I'm so touched he remembered that my eyes swim. He kisses me on the lips.
"Congratulations, babe. I knew you were incredible, and I didn't think you could surprise me anymore. But I was wrong. You are something else."
"You're incredible. I remember those words, too, imprinted as they are on my retina and sent to someone else. If I was smiling before, now I'm positively grinning."
"Can we eat now?"
Maddie asks, and we all laugh. Everyone gets their favorite, and we agree we will eat here as a family at least once a month from now on, which sends Mateo's eyes rolling back in his head. Carla is telling us about some coding camp she wants to go to when Maddie stops eating, fork up in the air, eyes firmly on the window. "What is it, sweetie?" I ask.
"There's someone watching us."
I turn around to follow his gaze, but all I see is a guy looking at the restaurant, the way you might when you're wondering if it's a nice place to eat at.
"Who are you talking about?" Lewis says.
"Outside,"
Maddie says. Then I get it. That young man is not gazing at the restaurant or the menu that is displayed outside. He's staring at me. But I have no idea who he is, except all of a sudden, I do. I know those eyes. My stomach rolls. It's Ryan. Ryan without a beard. Clean-shaven Ryan. Definitely Ryan, but he looks so young. His cheeks are flushed from the cold and the corners of his mouth are turned down, like he's upset about something.
"One of your fans?"
Lewis says, turning back to his food without looking at me. Hardly, I think. But I laugh. Probably.
"He doesn't look like a fan," Maddie says. "He looks angry."
I don't think he looks angry. I think he looks confused. Lewis squeezes my knee under the table and looks at me questioningly. I give him a quick shake of the head and go back to eating my food, wishing Ryan would go away, except he just stands there, still as a statue. I push pieces of duck around my plate and try to make light conversation, but my heart is beating too fast, too hard, and it's making the silk fabric of my dress visibly shudder with every beat. What if Ryan walks in and... what? Confronts me in front of my family? Tells everyone I rolled around on the carpet with him?
"I'll go and find out," Lewis says, throwing down his napkin. I quickly put one hand on his arm.
"That's okay," I say, trying to sound cheery and failing. "It's someone from work." I stand up so fast the table scrapes and shudders against my thighs, almost tipping our glasses over. I walk quickly outside into the cold air, unsure what I'm going to do or say, my stomach twisting a little more with every step. But Ryan isn't there anymore. I look around, but he's gone.
"You work with some weird people,"
Maddie says under his breath as I return to my seat. I laugh, embarrassed.
Someone from work? Lewis asks, one eyebrow at a sharp angle.
Yes, that's what I said. I hadn't recognized him at first. He works in the law department. He must have seen me and hesitated about coming in. I don't know. He was gone when I got outside. I pretend to laugh again, but I feel my mouth tremble with the effort of it. All I can think of is the word whore scratched on my car. The following Monday, I go straight to June's desk with a small potted green plant. For you, I say.
She beams as she takes it from me, reddens a little.
What for?
For helping me out with my car, of course. It's called a ZZ plant, and the florist assures me they're unkillable. Not that I doubt your nurturing skills, obviously, but, you know, in this place, between the floral lighting and the unreliable aircon.
Thank you. And you're very welcome, Anna. There was no need for that.
There was, and I wanted to. You've been so nice to me. For some reason, as I say this, I feel my lips tremble. It's the stress of everything. It's the car, the vandalism, Ryan. Obviously, I don't think it was kids anymore, but I don't tell her that. She tilts her head at me.
Everything all right?
Yes, everything is great. I just need to... I wave my hand vaguely in the direction of the elevator. Anyway, I'll see you later, all right? I leave her to find the right spot for her plant and march right out of the building and over to the law faculty, up the stairs and down the corridor to the admin office where I last saw Ryan. I walk in with clenched fists, a thumping heart, and a determined chin. The door to the admin office is opened, and I see him immediately, his back to me, sitting at his desk in the corner. I'm nervous, even shaking a little, but deep down I am seething with anger. What do you think you're doing? Did you do that to my car? Are you trying to intimidate me? Why? How dare you? I bark when I reach him. But the man who snaps his head around is not Ryan. He just looks a little bit like him from the back. He startles.
Excuse me?
I begin to stutter. I'm looking for Ryan.
Ryan?
He works here.
Oh, sorry. I don't work here. I mean, I don't work on this floor. I'm only using the scanner.
He's left, says someone. I turn around. A woman with short brown hair, older, is taking her glasses off and wiping them with a small piece of cloth.
Ryan, the IT guy, right?
I think so. I mean, his name is Ryan, and he was working in this office a few weeks ago. She nods.
The IT guy? He left a couple weeks ago. He doesn't work here anymore.
Where did he go? The woman shrugs.
Search me.
I nod. Try to think of what to do next.
Do you know where I can get an address for him? No idea. Try HR.
Back at my desk, I pull out the university directory that lives in my bottom drawer and find a number for HR. I put my query forward. I am looking for a contact address for someone called Ryan.
But you don't have a last name?
Unfortunately, I don't. He was an IT guy. That's all I know. I should have asked, of course. I was over there in his old office, talking to someone who clearly knew him. But I barely slept last night and I am not thinking straight. I could get a last name if I must, but do you have many Ryans in IT who left the university recently?
What was his position exactly?
I don't know. IT.
I know, but more precisely. Support desk. Network specialist? Hardware acquisitions?
He worked in the law building. Does that help?
No. There are no IT people who work directly in the law building. He must have been there on a specific job. And you're in the math building, is that right?
I rub a hand hard across my forehead. Yes, that's right. There's a pause.
The thing is, Dr. Sanchez, even if I did track the employee's home address, I'm not sure I'm at liberty to give it to you without his express permission. We have very strict privacy guidelines here, and I don't...
There's a rap at my door. It's June. Right, thank you. You've been very helpful. I hang up.
Yes? What is it?
She taps her watch.
They're waiting for you in 16B. Your class?
Oh, shit. I'll be right there. She narrows her eyes at me.
You sure you're okay?
Yes, I'm fine, thank you. Actually, June.
Yes?
Maybe you could help me with something?
Of course, what can I do?
I need to track down someone called Ryan, who was working in IT, but he's left. She waits for more, one hand on the door handle. I'm busy gathering my things for the class so I don't have to look at her.
I don't understand, she says. Do you need someone from IT to fix something?
No, I need to find this Ryan person. I look at her now, gnawing at my fingernail. I don't have a last name. I called HR, but they can't help me. I was thinking maybe...
I'm sorry, Anna. I don't know anyone called Ryan who is in IT, if that's your question.
I was hoping you could talk to HR. There can't be thousands of Ryans who worked in IT and were assigned to do a job at the law faculty recently, right?
But you said you already asked them.
Yes, but if you ask, they might tell you because you're admin too. Maybe admin people help other admin people, I don't know. Look, you know what? Don't worry about it. It's fine. I'll figure it out. I was just thinking out loud. I slip past her and out the door.
I'm happy to help if...
I raise a hand. No, it's fine. Thank you. Then I stop, turn around, and say, forget I said anything, okay? I'd be grateful if you didn't mention it to anyone.
Mention what?
I sigh. The Ryan thing. Just forget it, okay? I don't track down Ryan in the end, but I am on the alert, and it's only after a few days during which nothing happens that I begin to relax. He would have contacted me if he wanted to speak to me. He knows where I am. The ball is in his court, and there's not much I can do. Tonight, the university hosts a dinner in my honor. And I mean a real dinner, not the cheese plate and dips version. This is a linen and flowers and crystal glasses and silverware affair, all hired for the occasion and set up on long tables in the main hall. The dean, who is retiring at the end of term, gives a warm speech where he thanks me for making the last year of his career the proudest and most memorable. Lewis is looking very handsome in his tuxedo. He's chatting to Rohan about art and mathematics, I think. I'm chatting to Bernie, one of my postdoctoral students. He's telling me about a robot who can make an omelet. Shouldn't that be a robot that can make an omelet? I say. Bernie pulls his hair back and ties it into a ponytail with a rubber band that was around his wrist. People are more likely to trust robots that exhibit human traits, like gazing and nodding and shrugging. I like to think about robots as people. It makes me care more. Then June walks up to us, holding a flower arrangement in both hands, like an offering. She's smiling.
These just came for you, she says.
She puts the arrangement down on the table and Bernie stands up, brandishing an empty bottle of wine.
I'll get us a refill.
I'm sure the waiters will fix you up, I say, but he's already gone and June sits down in his place. I pull the arrangement closer and unfasten the clear cellophane. Purple lisianthus and daisies set in a white cube. Lewis turns around and peers over my shoulder as I open the card. Who's it from? He asks. I roll my eyes. Who do you think? My mother.
Congratulations, Anna. I'm very proud of you.
That's nice, June says.
I raise an eyebrow at her. Not really. She could have come. I invited her, you know. It wouldn't kill her to make the trip once in a while. I pointed the flowers with my chin. She always sends the same whenever there's a birthday in the family. When she remembers them, anyway. June helps herself to the jug of water.
You're not close?
You could say that. I never see her. She doesn't even come to visit her grandchildren.
No.
I shrug. She's not a caring person. Not in that way. And she's become a recluse of sorts in her old age. I fan myself with the card. That's beside the point anyway, as we were never close. I know this is going to sound strange, but my mother didn't like me very much.
June scoffs, shocked, I think.
I doubt that.
Please, you don't know her. But I can tell she doesn't believe me. Maybe she thinks I'm exaggerating, or that I'm put out because my mother hasn't shown up for me. I bring my chair closer to hers.
The thing is, both my parents were scientists, physicists to be exact. That's all they thought about, science. And they had ambitions for me because they believed, unscientifically I might add, that all of their talents would be funneled into me, that I would be their best work, my mother especially. I think my father just went along with her because it was easier for him. She, on the other hand, had this idea that I would be some kind of Marie Curie or Rosalind Franklin. She was obsessed with turning me into the perfect scientist. When I was 11, she told me not to have children. I'm not kidding, June. She said, they only interfere with the work. She always talked about the work like she was devoting her life to humanity or something. Children serve no purpose, she said, other than the survival of the family tree. And just to reiterate here, my mother said this to me, her only child. June is watching me, mouth open.
Oh, Anna, that's awful.
I shake my head. I could never be like that to my own children. I smother them in hugs and kisses every day just to balance her out.
June takes the card from me.
You are their best work, Anna.
She points to the words.
And she is proud of you.
Oh, yeah. I take the card from her and throw it on the table. Imagine waiting your whole life for this crumb. But I feel a prick of tears and pinch my nose. I want to tell June about my mother forcing the Penti Stone on me at such a young age, all the pain she put me through with her harebrained ideas. But I don't.
You'd think she would have come for this, I say.
June is silent for a moment.
What does Lewis think?
I check over my shoulder to make sure he's not listening, then lean closer to her.
He's so angry with her. She didn't even come to our wedding, can you believe that? He says I should just drop contact altogether. Not that we have much of that.
I laugh.
I'm very sorry, Anna. That's...
But we're interrupted by Mila.
You are a bit of a dark horse, Anna,
she slurs. She grabs my arm to drag me off. June laughs and waves me away and I get up, glass in hand.
I just wanted to say congratulations.
Thank you. I appreciate that. We clink our glasses. Her gestures are a little exaggerated.
I wish you'd said something. I would have loved to help, she says.
I just wanted to wait until I was sure, I say. She wags a finger at me.
You are a bit of a dark horse.
And I say, yes, you said that. And she laughs, congratulates me again. There's been a lot of congratulations lately, but there's something in her eyes that doesn't match the smile. For a terrifying moment, I think that she suspects something, and my heart leaps into my throat. I try to picture Alex and Mila together, confiding, chatting, plotting, but no, it doesn't resonate. I don't think Alex even liked Mila much anyway. Then I tell myself that I have to stop this second guessing of everything everyone says to me or I'll really go crazy. Mila lifts her glass of champagne in my direction and says,
You kept it secret so I wouldn't try to worm it out of you. You think I would have stolen it for myself?
She leans forward again.
You're right. I would have. Well done, you.
Then Jeff appears and puts his arms around both of us. I told Mila to write up a story on you for the website, Jeff says. We want a big splash page thing. Photos, quotes, the lot. Did she tell you?
Not yet.
Yes, she says dully. What's a good day for you?
And I see then she doesn't like that one bit, that Jeff has asked her to do something probably quite mundane in her eyes, and that she thinks it's a subordinate task. and I want to laugh because suddenly I see she has lost some of her glow. Jeff has backed the wrong horse. He should have promoted the dark horse, I guess, not the pretty shiny one.
I bet he asks her to take minutes from now on.
And if I were unkind, I'd say this is one of the best moments of the night. I'm asked to make a speech, even though we've had many of them already. I rise to the occasion, and I thank my colleagues, the university, my students. Then I thank Lewis. I look right at him when I tell the room that the most important thing in my life isn't mathematics. It's my family. That I have done this for my husband and especially for my children, so that they'd look up to their mom someday, which makes everyone laugh, even though it's the truth.
Chapter 17. Word has spread about the Penty Stone, and I stand in a packed lecture hall staring at faces I'm sure I've never seen before. I don't know if they simply never showed up for class or if they don't belong here in the first place. Thorn in my side, Melanie, still managed to stake her place at the front, and when our eyes meet, she takes the gum out of her mouth and sticks it on a piece of paper in front of her. That's a first. Perhaps some of the infinite advantages in winning prizes includes respect. I lose some of these first-time attendees, though, somewhere between complex analysis and Riemann surfaces. By the time the class ends, the sloping lecture hall is dotted with empty seats. It's actually hard not to feel slighted, that I wasn't as riveting as all that. When the class ends and I return to my office, I run into June in the corridor.
Jeff said you asked for extra support.
Yes, I'm a bit overwhelmed with everything since the win.
Well, from now on, I'm to assist you with any admin work.
She does a little captain's call, tipping her hand to her head. I laugh. That's nice. I'm glad. I've actually got a bunch of things for you to do. Let me put it together. You have time this afternoon to go over it with me? She seems pleased.
I certainly do. Name your time.
Okay.
Also, would you like to go for a quick drink after work? Maybe even something to eat?
I give her a confused tilt of the head. We've never done that before, socialize outside work. She registers my hesitation and gives me a quick, apologetic smile.
But I understand completely if you're busy at home. It's just a thought, a spur of the moment.
I hesitate for a moment because Lewis said last night that his sale fell through. Turns out the Nest is not going to a prestigious institution, and Isabel was talking out of her proverbial. Part of me thinks I should be there for him. The other part thinks, screw it. You know what? I'm not busy, and I would really like that. I'll call Lewis and tell him.
He won't mind?
No. Trust me, there's truckloads of dinners ready to be reheated in my freezer. They'll be fine. She suggests the tapas bar on Jefferson Avenue. It's close. The food is excellent. Perfect, I say. And suddenly, I'm really looking forward to a night out with a friend. I haven't had a friend in a long time. I've forgotten how nice it feels. Then Mila appears beside us like something that's sprung out of a box.
Ready?
She asks chirpily, then turns to June.
I'm interviewing Anna for the website.
June and I make a timed catch up later, and Mila and I continue on into my office. It's a brand new office, four times the size of my old one, with lovely windows overlooking the landscaped lawns. Mila makes all the right noises about how nice it is and sits right on the edge of the armchair. I drop loosely into the other one. Okay, let's go, I say. I'm not concerned. I'm lining up lots of these interviews. I even have one coming up with the New York Times for their Profiles in Science series. That's the big one. In comparison, this chat with Mila feels like a walk in the park.
Sure, okay,
she says, pulling out her iPhone and setting it down on the table.
I'm recording this. You don't mind?
Of course not.
Okay, good. So, I'd love to know about your process. How long have you been working on the proof?
And just like that,
My confidence evaporates. I feel ridiculously unprepared, and now I want more time. I've been so cocky. I think I just assumed this would be a gushing session about how fabulous I am.
A year? I say finally. Her eyebrows shoot up.
Wow, is that all?
Oh, okay, I meant probably 3 years then. She tilts her head at me.
So what is it? 1 year or three?
Three, I think. I could have said my whole life, and that would be almost true. I think the reason I don't is because I hate to talk about that time of my childhood, when the Penti Stone conjecture represented nothing less than an instrument of torture.
Okay.
She writes it down. Then she wants to know why I kept the research secret for so long. I hesitate.
Is it because as a woman you were worried you wouldn't be taken seriously? She asks.
Yes. I nod slowly. That's very perceptive of you. Then she asks,
have you some supporting documentation? Anything we can upload to the website to accompany your article? And that isn't in the journal's paper? Something you held back from Forrester?
I cock my head at her. Supporting documentation?
You know, your notebooks, work in progress, scribbles, doodles, anything you have that would be good visual material for the project. Visuals are great for this sort of thing. It doesn't matter if it's messy. The messier, the better.
I rub a finger on my forehead. Okay, let me think. I don't actually have much. She chuckles.
But you must have notes. You didn't publish a preprint, right?
A preprint? No. It's unusual to publish a proof directly like I did. Normally, you'd have a draft version made freely available for others to provide feedback on. I don't have a preprint. Obviously. I didn't need one. I threw a lot of things away when I moved office. You know how it is. I might have thrown my notes, too. She waits for me to say more, a cloud of confusion in her eyes.
But you submitted them to the Forrester Foundation.
Something tugs at the edge of my brain when she says that. What do you mean? She tilts her head at me.
It's part of the rules. You know that, right? The Forrester Foundation will only award the prize if you submit all the notebooks. You have to show how you came to the solution.
Oh, right. I blink, breathe a sigh of relief. For a moment I thought she meant. I don't know what I thought. All I know is I've already done that. I did that when I submitted the paper. It's all in the published paper.
Well, not really. Without supporting documentation, notebooks, workings, all that, they won't give you the prize. I mean, these are the rules. You know that, right?
I wish she'd stop asking me that. I laugh. Of course I know that. I raise my hand. You know what? It doesn't matter. I'll dig up any relevant notebooks I have and bring them along. But I remember now. An email that came shortly after the foundation confirmed my solution was accepted. Something about sending them documentation. I ignored it. I don't know why. I thought it was for their records or something. Now I wait until she's gone to pore over the fine print on the foundation's website. And there it is. The submission must include the preliminary work that led to the discovery. Then a paragraph detailing what's acceptable in terms of documentation. I sit back, push the palm of my hand between my eyes. I have a vague memory of knowing about this requirement, but I didn't think it was compulsory. Did Alex and I ever discuss this? Of course, one requirement was that a paper be published about the solution in a reputable journal, and I've done that, and that's enough, surely. Who cares how I got there? It was stupid of me to destroy the notebooks. I should have copied them first, so I'd have the workings in my own handwriting. I could have added rings from overflowing coffee cups, spilled red wine, make it look like I'd been working late at night.
I wasn't thinking straight back then. Never mind. It will be fine. Of course it will be. They wouldn't have said I'd won the Penty Stone otherwise. I'm sure this so-called requirement is not absolute. I mean, I solved it, didn't I? The whole world knows I solved it. They could hardly not give me the prize. And if they ask, I'll just say something. I'll think of something. It'll be fine. The tapas bar isn't very far, and June and I decide to walk. We're almost there when the weather changes abruptly, and we wrap our coats tighter, raise our collars, and squint against the icy wind. I take her hand to hurry her along, and we almost fall into the restaurant, laughing, our cheeks red and our coats sparkling with melting crystals. It's early enough to score a good table near the window. We drop ourselves on the hard wooden bench, rub our hands together, and immediately order margaritas with lime juice and dry orange curacao. They arrive in jam jars while we scan the menu. Conversation flows. We find ourselves on a new level of friendship. I've asked her before about her personal life, but she's always been cagey.
I'm not in a relationship. Not anymore, anyway, she said. Trevor. That's his name. We were together for years, and 18 months ago I found out he was seeing my best friend behind my back. That's why I moved away and ended up here. New beginnings and all that. And the rent is cheap here.
I'm sorry, June. That really sucks.
Yeah, I'm getting over it. Tell me about your mother.
She rests her elbows on the table, hands knotted together. I cock my head at her. You want to know about my mother? I rub my eye, unwind the scarf I'm still wearing around my neck and fold it on the bench beside me. Okay, I'll tell you about her. I cross my arms on the table. The best way to explain my mother is to tell you about my friend Hope. I take a sip of my drink. I grew up in Youngstown, and it was there in middle school that Hope arrived one morning, in the middle of term. As soon as I saw her sitting at her desk that day, I wanted to get to know her. It was like friendship at first sight. She looked sweet, kind, with curly blonde hair, almost red, and she had chipped pink nail polish. Our teacher, Mrs. Johnson, asked for a volunteer to look after our new classmate, show her around, that sort of thing. I couldn't raise my hand fast enough. I'd do it, absolutely. You can count on me, Mrs. Johnson, I said. I'd never had a real friend until Hope. Her parents were hippies who made clothes out of ethically grown cotton and sold them at markets and in local stores. I loved to hang out at her house, so much so that I was there all the time. It was warm and comfortable, and even the furniture was welcoming, with its soft shapes you could sink into and its bright, happy colors. My parents didn't care about making a home, let alone a welcoming one. They were too busy, and probably in some weird way thought it was beneath them anyway. They worked, like, all the time. Even when they weren't working, they were working. As a result, my house was spartan and neglected. Sometimes when they went out, I would pull out the vacuum cleaner from under the stairs and clean the living room to within an inch of its life. I'd squeeze lemons into a cup of water and dip my fingers in, flicking droplets over the carpet so that my house would smell like Hope's house, which it never did. I even made cushions once, with some fabric Hope's mother gave me, red with big blue and green flowers. My parents didn't notice. When I pointed this out to them, my parents looked around mildly bewildered and muttered something like, "Very nice." At Hope's house, we'd sit on beanbags in her room and listen to Michael Jackson. She showed me her parents' stash of pot once. "Smell that," she said. I thought it smelled like rotting mushrooms, which probably wasn't far from the truth. We'd talk about what we would do when we grew up, kind of like what Lewis and I would do years later in college. But there was my mother. She disapproved, obviously, eventually, once she took the time to notice. Sometimes I think she simply didn't like seeing me happy. That it went against her grain, I should be studying instead, or something. It's okay, you're rebelling. It's what most girls your age do, she'd said. And I remember thinking, I'm 13 years old. I have no idea what you're talking about, Mother.
So what happened? June asks.
It was almost summer. Hope had her 14th birthday party at her house. It was a Saturday afternoon, and my mother forbade me to go. But Hope helped me sneak out through my bedroom window. I was probably there for only an hour before my mother came to get me. I bury my face in my hands and groan. You should have seen her. It was the most embarrassing day of my life. Hope's mother tried to coax her to stay. There were other parents there enjoying the party. And she offered her a glass of something that she'd poured from a large glass pitcher that had floating bits of fruit in it. But my mother stood there, her face white with fury, her lips pressed together in a thin line. She saw me, marched over, and yanked me away. And that was it. I was grounded for the rest of the year. June jerks back in shock.
The year?
I nod. She found a project for me. A mathematics project.
What?
The Penty Stone conjecture. I take a swig of my drink.
I don't really know what that means, Anna.
It was to punish me for disobeying her. Although I'm sure she'd argue it was for my own education. But after that party, my mother declared that I was too possessive in my friendships, and it was unhealthy. I wasn't, by the way, June. I really believe I was just a normal child, but she insisted I needed a distraction from my distractions. Next thing I know, she announced that we would solve the Penty Stone conjecture. I say we because she was going to do it with me. She thought it would be, I don't know, fun, I guess. Her idea of mother-daughter bonding. Except that I did all the work. Her only contribution was to check on my progress. She'd come into my bedroom and pick up my work, go over it, maybe ask me a question or two. Sometimes I thought I was on the right track and I'd say to her, "Is it right? Would that work?" But she'd just shake her head. "No, that's not going to work," she'd say. Then she'd take my pen from me, put a diagonal line through the page, and give me the notebook back. "Try again," she'd say, and I would cry myself to sleep. It felt so hopeless. I was never going to get it. I was locked up all summer, every day. I missed Hope so much, I used to dream about her. I fantasized that she was trying to find ways to get me out, that we'd run away. Even after we went back to school the following term, I was locked up every weekend. Metaphorically speaking, of course, but still, in my room, poring over it, trying to come up with a proof just so I could get out and play. Until then, no movies for me, no dances, no hanging out after school playing by the lake with my friends. Not that I had many of those to begin with. I poke at an anchovy with my fork. I was 13 years old. Grown men and women had spent years trying to solve that thing. My dad just pretended it wasn't happening. He deferred to my mother in every way anyway, a lifelong habit he was not going to break, not even for his daughter's welfare. I feel a prickle of tears. I grab a napkin and press it against my eyes. "I don't know why I'm getting upset," I say. "It's a long time ago." The restaurant suddenly feels uncomfortably hot. I scrunch up the napkin into a ball. It should go without saying I grew to loathe the Penty Stone conjecture. I still do. So you can imagine when Alex came to me with... I stop, leave the words hanging in the air. I want them to float away, but they're still there, between us. I can't think of anything to say, and I look at June pleadingly, my mouth opening and closing like a fish.
"When Alex what?"
June prompts. But she doesn't frown or narrow her eyes, and there's no suspicion or shock in her tone,
or anything to indicate I said the wrong thing. I feel my insides loosen and I shake my head.
Nothing, I finally reply. Ignore me. I don't know what I'm saying anymore. Hey, shall we get another margarita?
Sure, why not?
She flags the waitress while I stare at my hands and will my heart to slow down. I can't believe I almost blurted it when Alex came to me with the proof. June pats my arm.
And you did it. You did solve it.
I smile. We sit there in silence for a while, staring into our glasses.
So what happened to Hope? She asks.
I shrug. The party was just before the end of term, and I only saw her once after that, in class. And then her family moved away, so that was that. We drifted apart. I don't know where she is now. I don't really like to think about those years, to tell you the truth. It's in the past now. I run my finger along my glass, leaving a trace in the condensation. My mother used to say, back when she still talked to me, that I was an over-attached child. I would cling to her, she said. Then I met Hope, and I clung to Hope until they moved away. And maybe she was right. Because now I cling to Louis, and my children, of course, but especially Louis. Louis is the only friend I ever had after Hope. The only friend that is truly mine. I haven't even seen my mother in years, as she refuses to visit us. I told you she didn't come to our wedding, didn't I? June nods, biting into a small mushroom. This is how horrible she is. Are my words sounding a little slurred? Before we got married, she called me. She said not to marry him. Something was wrong with him.
What do you mean? I asked.
But I knew what she meant. She saw I was happy. She was going to do it again, try to ruin it for me. I scoff. I mean, really? I'm about to get married to the love of my life, and she tells me there's something wrong with him? I make air quotes around something. I laughed at her. I said, yeah, he loves me, Mother. That's what's wrong with him. Seriously, that woman will stop at nothing to ruin any chance of happiness for me. It's like it's embedded in her DNA. I told her, honestly, Mother, enough. I'm a grown woman. I can do what I like. Save it. She didn't come to my wedding after that. And then she moved away.
Where to?
Some small town in California called Clear Lake. I've emailed her that we'll come and visit. Take the kids on vacation. Most grandparents would love that, wouldn't they? You'd think so, wouldn't you? But no, not this one.
But did you find out what she meant? About Louis?
June asks. I give her a look. Please. These were just the games she liked to play. There was nothing wrong with Louis. He loves me, and she couldn't stand that because she's a sick woman. He is the only person left in my life who truly loves me. Sometimes, in my darkest hour, I believe that I will meet so few people in my life who will truly love me that when I find one, I have to hold on to them with everything I have. Chapter 18. We're talking about relationships, and I want to know more about Trevor, but June's not saying much, and I get a sense that she's still too sad to talk about it. I lift a greasy finger. Okay, so final question. How would you describe him in one word? She thinks about it and smiles.
Funny, she says. He was really funny. He used to make me laugh a lot.
I try to ask more, but she waves my questions away with a flap of the hand.
What about Louis, in one word?
I peel a prawn and sink my teeth into its flesh. Unfaithful, I say, sucking on the tail. She gasps, and I look up abruptly. It's like the word escaped from me without my realizing it was even there. I start to laugh, but she's looking at me, her head tilted, her eyebrows drawn together. I want to say something, but I'm stuck, and my eyes start to swim.
Louis is having an affair?
Her eyes grow wide with understanding, but disbelief also, which makes sense considering I've just waxed lyrical about what a great husband and father he is for the last 20 minutes. Hearing it like that, without adornments, is like having the carpet pulled from under my carefully constructed house of cards. I immediately regret saying anything, but it's too late. It's fine, June. He's not having an affair anymore. It's over.
Oh, Anna. How did you find out?
I tell her about my suspicions, then seeing him with Isabel, and finally the coup de grace, finding the texts. Especially the texts.
How do you know it's over?
I just know.
Have you checked his texts again?
I shake my head. His cell isn't always on his bedside table, and to be honest, I feel like I got away with it once. I'm not game to try it again.
So how do you know?
I tell her what it's been like, how sweet he's been. I show her my silver earrings, which I happen to be wearing. He remembered I liked them, I say. And they're heart-shaped. You know what that means? That we're in love again, that's what. Not that we ever stopped, but you know, it's gone back to the way it used to be, in a way. I smile at her. But the words sound hollow, and I wonder if I ever really believed them. And his show is over, so he has no reason to go to the gallery anymore.
Right,
she says, staring intently at her plate. What does that mean? She shrugs.
Nothing. What do I know? I'm an idiot.
Hey, that's my line. Come on, tell me.
Just that,
she sighs, puts her fork down.
Listen to yourself, Anna. Why would Louis stop seeing Isabel just because you're trying so hard to be perfect? He can have his cake and eat it too, as far as I can see.
She registers the shock on my face and raises her hand.
Look, I'm only saying this because I've been there and I did all the things you did. I was the perfect girlfriend and he still left me for her. Of course, it's very possible the affair is over, but you don't know that. You should be in control of this situation, Anna, not try and second guess it. If he's going to stop seeing, what's her name again?
Isabel.
If he's going to stop seeing Isabel, it should be because you made it happen.
I laugh. I thought I was. Believe me, I've turned up the seduction dial to stratospheric. What else are you suggesting?
Confront him. Give him an ultimatum. Make him take responsibility for his actions.
I'm such a loser. Of course she's right. And yet, what if he picks her? I say in a small voice.
He won't.
Then she thinks about it and shrugs.
And if he does, well, he would have left sooner or later. But he won't.
She says again.
Have you checked his toiletries bag for condoms?
What? No. Why his toiletries bag? I'm not even sure he has one.
That's where Trevor kept them. Alternatively, you could always confront her. Have you considered that?
How do I do that? March up to her at work and make a public spectacle of myself?
Of course not.
She pauses.
You know what would be helpful here, I think, is if you could see them together. You could probably gauge a lot from how they interact. Like, are they trying too hard not to interact? You know what I'm saying?
I don't know how to do that either, I say sullenly.
Look, Anna, it's up to you. Don't listen to me. I'm the one who couldn't keep my own boyfriend, so what do I know? I'm sure you're right. It's over.
The first thing I think of when I wake up the next day, my head heavy and blurry, my tongue thick, my heart beating too hard, is that I wish I hadn't told June about Louis and Isabel. But as the fog clears, I decide that she's right. Winning the Penty Stone Prize has made me complacent, if not a little smug.